Greetings and good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Wednesday, July 26th, 2017. It is a scorching hot day here in Nashville. For the first time today, I've packed up my computer and my microphone and taken the podcast down the road. Well, not too far, just to Radnor Lake. This natural area will be familiar to our Nashville listeners. My friends will know that I'm a frequent visitor there. Beth and I have been walking there on an average of once a week for at least 10 years. My first visits there were in 1978 or 1979, a few short years after the property was acquired by the state. So I probably have had occasion to observe the changes at this park more than any other park. There have been a lot of changes and enhancements to the park over the years. A visitor center has been built, parking lots, an aviary, but no change has been more important than the change in the landscape itself. In the past few years, park staff, together with an army of volunteers, have made extraordinary efforts to eradicate invasive exotic plants, which at one time predominated in this area. Park administrators have been aware of the problem of invasive exotics for many years. However, the scale of the problem seemed so overwhelming, it defied solution. And so I sat down with park manager Steve Ward to talk about the park generally and to hear from him about the efforts that they have made and the outstanding results that they've achieved in eradicating the invasive exotics. I hope you will enjoy my conversation with this energetic park leader. Steve Ward, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Glad you're making some time to see me today. And as we've talked before we got on the mic, let's make sure we speak loudly so everybody can hear. Tell us about yourself, Steve. You've been here at Radnor Lake State Park as the superintendent here for how many years?
I arrived in December of 2001. Okay. So I've been here ever since and loved every minute.
Tell me about your background before that.
I've been a state park ranger for 22 years, okay. Going into my 23rd year. Started out in 1995. I was an intern at Henry Horton State Park, and that evolved to a ranger position. I was one of the first 7 rangers hired at the Bicentennial Mall. Okay. Worked nights there for a year before it was even open, primary law enforcement. It was a different time then, a different place than what our visitors experience now.
Right.
And was fortunate to be part of that park opening in June of 1996. And then went back to Henry Horton State Park for a little over 2 years as a park ranger. And then transferred out to Pinson Mound State Archaeological Area.
Right.
It's a park ranger there.
Just south of Jackson, Tennessee.
13 miles south of Jackson.
Right.
So it's one of our two primary state archaeological areas that are state parks. Right. So phenomenal place there.
Huge, big mound there.
Yeah.
Saul's Mound.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. Yes. So, and then came back home. I'm from Donaldson. I grew up in Donaldson, Tennessee.
Okay. So Davidson County.
Davidson County. Okay. Came back and and been here ever since.
What about schooling in preparation for your work here?
Yeah, I graduated from MTSU.
Okay.
With a geoscience degree with a minor in criminal justice.
Okay.
So this is what I wanted to...
You probably knew Ralph Fullerton out there.
I did. Dr. Fullerton was the department chair when I started.
Right, yeah. I interviewed Zeta Law last week, who's the director of that department now. We talked about the Fort Nagley thing, but... Yeah. Interesting that connection today. Okay, so we're here at Radnor Lake State Park, State Natural Area. Tell us geographically where that is.
We're 8 miles south of the capital, center of Nashville, Tennessee. We were set aside in 1973 as the state of Tennessee's first natural area, which all of that came from the State Natural Areas Preservation Act of 1971 under Governor Dunn's leadership. That single piece of legislation has led us now to 86 natural areas across the state, which is managed by the Division of Natural Areas, and Roger McCoy is the director of that division.
Okay. Some of those are state-owned and some are not.
That's correct. Right. Some are privately managed or owned, and some are state. And If you've never been to any of the others, we have phenomenal, like Frozen Head State Natural Area, about 20,000 acres up there. David Engelbretson is the manager there, does a phenomenal job with his staff. They're just some of our jewels of the state.
Well, this property, it's kind of an odd situation where the lake is the prominent feature of the natural area, but it isn't a natural lake.
Yeah, I tell visitors every day, the irony of Radnor Lake is our main feature is a man-made lake for a state natural area.
But that's certainly not everything that's here.
Absolutely not. Yeah. It's just the thing that gets a lot of people here.
Right. Now, when this property was first acquired, it was like 690, 700 acres, something like that, being threatened with development and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it was, that original tract was owned by, the lake was built in 1912 by the L&N Railroad to provide a water source for steam engines and livestock on the rail, which is about 3 miles away.
Right.
So if you can think back to 1912, there's no GPS, there's no backhoes and bulldozers and all those things that we don't think twice of today. And somehow they engineered a 3 mile plus gravity fed pipe.
Wow.
All the way over to Radnor Yards, and it provided water for that. You know, in the story of Radnor Lake, we always want to make sure we're clear on it. There's a lot of success stories of Radnor, but Radnor was not a pristine virgin timber forest that was preserved at the last minute. It was an industrial complex, and the story of Radnor is that sense of place. What happens when you let nature do what it wants to do? And a group of people that cared enough to make it happen in the early 1970s.
How many acres are now in the park?
We're at 1,402 this year. We added 23 acres last year. We're on target for 21 acres this year.
Okay.
And we're adding acre every year. We're adding acreage.
A lot of that through the efforts of the Friends of Radnor Lake and fundraising and that sort of thing.
We got a lot of partners. The main partnership is the partnership between the state of Tennessee and the Friends of Radnor Lake.
Right.
And we work with a lot of foundations, a lot of individual donors. And the most important component of that is the landowner, most of the time. We acquired 75 acres of the Cheek Tract to the north. We got that at $10,000 to $13,000 an acre when it appraised,
probably
$100,000. Yeah, $100,000.
Exactly.
So that was John and Kay Cheek's legacy. And they worked with us over about a 9-year period to make all that happen.
Wow,
so
terrific story.
It's a lot of partnerships and a lot of people rowing in the same direction.
I want to talk with you today, and you've given us a great introduction as describing this land as an industrial complex when the state first got it. When I first started walking around here, it was 78 or 79, and at that time, the trail system was really not laid out properly. The trails were real close to the lake itself. Now they're situated further back. There had been no emphasis on trail surfacing at all. It was just a mud and dust situation all the time. And the place was completely overrun with invasive exotic plants. Now, some of our listeners will not be familiar with that nomenclature, talking about invasive exotics. I first learned about invasive exotics when I came into the state parks and saw kudzu at Indian Mountain State Camping Park in Jellicoe, Tennessee. But this place was overrun with honeysuckle, with privet hedge, with tree of heaven, mimosa, honeysuckle vines. And as I walk the property today, it's virtually clear. I mean, there are certainly places where you've got things coming back, but it is so remarkably different than it was back in 78. And tell us the story about the state park's efforts to remove the invasive exotics here.
Yeah, invasive exotic plants, it's a dual definition.
Okay.
Invasive means it's not native to this region of the country or even maybe the United States. Or exotic. Invasive means that it accelerates growth on its own, generally at a faster pace than anything that's native to this area. So I always use the analysis when I'm giving a program on it or a hike. It's like a baseball player on steroids playing against a player that's doing it the manner they should.
Right.
It has a distinct competitive advantage, and it outcompetes everything in nature.
Right. Right.
So one year we did a test cutting on a tree I have in one of the plants you mentioned.
Right.
We cut it on March 1st at the stump. This is in ideal conditions. Full sunlight, moisture. It grew 18 feet by October 1st.
Goodness.
And that was untreated on its own. That is unheard of
right.
for a native plant in Tennessee or in the Southeast.
Right.
Kudzu is probably, from a visitor standpoint, what most people clicks their button and they go, okay, I get it. I understand. Kudzu vine's bad. I've seen what it does driving down the interstate. Or
there was some of the kudzu here on the haul track years ago.
There
I don't
was.
Know whether that's still there.
There was. And it was actually gone when I got here in 2001.
Okay.
They had a small parcel of it there.
Yeah.
The invasive exotics typically come in, they transfer by seed or wind. Birds transfer a lot of that seed. Wind, tree of heaven, for example, when they have seed pods, when they develop, it'll blow those seed pods. I think it's 300 something yards from the actual tree. So there's a lot of factors there. How it gets a foothold. So you were talking about your sense of place, 1978 here, kind of a field succession type area. That new sunlight from those areas that were past pasture areas were ideal for that to explode.
Okay.
So most of those plants need sunlight. There's a few that as the forest matures, it works to our advantage. Multiflora rose is an example.
Okay.
It needs sun. It'll grow in part sun, but it stops being invasive, as invasive as the less sunlight it gets. So you'll see that develop and change. If you had a full area with multiflora rose, it would explode and take off. So we see some newer ones that aren't quite as invasive as these other plants we mentioned. Mahonia is a landscaping plant. One of my least favorites is actually winter creeper, which is a landscaping vine.
It's the euonymus vine.
It's in the euonymus family.
Yep.
And it's very aggressive. It kills trees. It takes over landscapes. So that's one. We have a certain way we treat those. They climb up a tree. We cut about a 2 or 3 foot section out of the tree. We treat the stump of the vine, and it takes about 4 months, and it'll die out.
Okay. So how have you gone about the process of planning your work for getting, I mean, just to sit down and think about 1,000 acres and trying to do, how did you devise a plan to tackle that?
One of my good friends and current bosses, Mike Robertson, the head of State Parks, we've been friends for 20 years, and he was my regional supervisor. He's now the director of park operations. But we took the approach, and Mike has always coined this phrase, wherever it came from, which is, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time.
Right.
And we took that approach going into that. In 2001, there was not a set volunteer day here. We established that in 2002. The fourth Saturday of every month, the majority of the year, we have a set volunteer day. So we started with that,
okay. And
we started two focuses, trails and exotic plants. And we felt those two things, both was an education opportunity and B, an opportunity to feel where people really could come back and see the difference they made.
Exactly.
On the ground. So that snowballed over time. It developed. And now we're at about 2,500 to 3,000 volunteers a year. That's usually on a minimum of 3 to 4 hours each. We had volunteers here the last 2 days working on trails. So we also had to come up with a time frame of that was the most efficient and work around some limiting factors, things like poison ivy, ticks, mosquitoes. And then back to our core mission.
In other words, those things are problems. In other words, volunteers don't
That's
want
right.
to come out here if they're going to get
That's
poison
right.
ivy and get
That's
get
right.
bitten by
snakes.
Snakes
is another thing.
Right.
We don't want to put our volunteers in those spots.
Exactly.
So what we came up with is and the reinforcing factor on this the main reason we did it is nesting season. Birding species nest in these plants, whether they're invasive or native plants.
Okay.
So we took an approach early on that from October 1 until about April 1st was our window. We're not going to do any exotic removal. It's a general rule. Occasionally we'll do a treatment or a hand pull of an area for maintenance, but it's a general rule. That's our window to work in, where we stay out of all those things like ticks, snakes, doing any damage to the wildlife.
And your volunteers come from what sort of sources?
Everywhere.
Okay.
And they keep coming. And they're great, every one of them. It depends on the time of year. Right now, we get a lot of corporate groups. We've got Nissan scheduled for September 29th, a big corporate day here for National Public Lands Day. We just set that about 2 weeks ago. We just had two church groups coming in through here on Monday and Tuesday. Last week, we had some groups in here visiting town. They rotate in when they're here for these church functions. So they rotate in and do some community service, 3-4 hours.
And this takes a lot of time on the part of your staff to.
It does.
I mean, you just can't turn people loose in the woods and say, start pulling weeds. You have to tell them, you have to be there with them.
Yeah.
And tell them what's a weed and what's not a weed.
Yeah, so you're exactly right. I think that there's three reasons why I think that's been successful to date, and I hope it continues on the path we're going. The entire staff's bought in. Our administrative assistant, she helps manage that. She helps schedule those. She knows what she's talking about in terms of how to do it, what works for the rangers, what time of day we can do it. The rangers do all the prep work and post work and scout it out and all that. They do all that behind the scenes work. And then Friends of Radnor Lake support us financially with a small budget to help to feed those volunteers pizza.
I got you.
They're also our facilitator. I have two visitors, Rick and Dana Short, great visitors. They donate to us countless cases of water every year. I mean, they just dropped off about 26 cases here last month. So
that's something I wouldn't have thought of.
Yeah,
that's just true.
It's critical. Yeah. You're a mile in on a trail pulling exotics. So all those things, I've had companies give us gloves and from my standpoint, the other part that's as important or more important, I have the support from the top. We've got Roger McCoy, Division Axillaries. Whenever we find a new plan or something we don't know, I can get him on the phone in 10 minutes. They're involved with us on this planning on where and how we do this. So it's a team effort, and I always appreciate the volunteers. I tell them when they come here, the first thing we say is, we don't get to talk to you individually the rest of the day. Your time's the most valuable thing, and we know it.
Fun.
So
when you're out trying to work on invasives, what are the techniques that you utilize?
Well, the best technique is pulling it out of the ground.
Okay.
There's no chemicals involved. There's no chainsaws or petroleum, nothing. We really like to get it where it's about 12 inches, 18 inches tall. And if you can get to that point, especially if you've got rainfall in the previous few days, you can generally pull that stuff out by hand or we have pullers.
Right.
That's a
mechanical puller.
Gives us mechanical advantage.
Yep.
And that's our preferred method.
Right.
It's slow. It's a methodical process. But if we had to pick, that's it.
Right.
When you get plants as big as, 10 foot tall, bush honeysuckle or tree heaven, that's a chainsaw. And we call that stump cut method. We cut it as close to the ground as we can. We treat it, the stump, with a generic, we use a product called Rodeo.
Okay.
It's approved by the EPA for wetlands. We use this in wet areas that are not wetlands, just as a security blanket.
Okay.
Costs a little more, but we think it's worth it as far as the safety factor. And we also put a non-petroleum dye in it so we can tell which stumps we treated.
I got you.
Which ones didn't, so we don't overuse any of the product.
All right. And you found that to be effective?
Absolutely.
Now you have to go back. Some of these plants, for instance, privet, tree of heaven, the seeds will lie dormant in the soil for a long time. I know that I cut a mimosa tree down in my backyard in 1983, the year we moved in to the house. And we still have mimosa babies coming up 30, 40 years later. So you have to go back and check these places out.
We do, and that's the ranger's role. The rangers come in there. We're out there every day. We're hiking the trails every day. We're hiking these areas. We have a four-step plan or four-phase plan.
Okay.
That we do this. And the initial is, let's just say it's a mature stand of privet. You go in and cut it the first time. You do the stump cut method. You pull as much as you can.
Right.
On the smaller plants. You're going to do that twice. So you're going to have two times that you end up doing that within a year period, maybe a two-year period, depending on how much time you've got. The third time you go through the same area, it is either a pull, you've got a group of volunteers that get online and go wade through it and pull it, or it's a follow-up treatment spray. And then the fourth is maintenance. Okay. The fourth is what birds transfer. It's those seeds that have been dormant. Usually you get a lot of those in the third phase, but that's kind of in maintenance mode. That's where we want it. So when you hike the trails today, when you see plants that are about every 10 yards apart, that's in maintenance mode. We've got it to where we want it. We're winning the battle.
So you might see the occasional privet.
Absolutely.
Bush.
Or bush honeysuckle. Yeah. When we get it to there, we're going to win.
Right. Exactly. So what have you noticed, I mean, just sort of walking along, just looking at the forest, I can notice the difference. Now, a lot of people wouldn't notice the difference. I can see that this is a natural forest. I can see that it's a forest that basically consists of native trees and shrubs, herbaceous plants. But what are you seeing that you haven't seen since you've cut some of these things out?
Well, usually what we see once we remove it, if we start there, you see a couple of things. You see past land use. So areas that we know that were field, let's say a lot of the area around the lake trail was field up to around 1960, okay, from aerial photographs and other things. Those areas, you see this native vegetation coming back. Things like spice bush. It's a native shrub we got. It's great for birds. It's a berry on it about August.
You great see for those butterflies as well.
Yeah, spice bush. Yeah, very good. Yeah. Very good. Yeah. So that's what we really like to see. That's what the understory should look like. And more importantly, when you look under the understory, you shouldn't see just one thing. That's the same. You know, invasive plants create what we call a monoculture. Okay. One plant.
Okay.
What you want to see is this year-round change of things blooming, seeding, all those things at different times. That is a healthy ecosystem. And likewise, you will see different wildlife patterns in those areas that reflect that.
Have you noticed a difference in the ephemeral spring wildflowers?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Things like the dwarf larkspur, right, are the most obvious. We had that on the lake trail. It was here in 2001. We had a pocket of it on the lake trail over there, just past the bench 24, 26 area, right there at the Ganya Ridge Junction. We brought in an AmeriCorps team. We did an application for AmeriCorps team and the ranger staff, and we cleared 40 acres between Ganya Ridge and the lake trail.
Gracious.
And it takes about 18 months for you to feel that effect. So that's in the winter months. It was like January, February. So about 18 months later, you see this explosion of purple flower. And there's photographs ever since that document it, and
Couldn't have happened before.
No, because it was that baseball analogy. It was outcompeted for nutrients, right, and sunlight.
Right.
So that
with the bush honeysuckle is the first thing in the spring to put on green, and it shades the forest floor, so that the spring wildflowers don't have a prayer to come up.
In 2017, the first bush honeysuckle I saw leaf out was February 13th. Which is winter. It's supposed to be winter for us. So you're exactly right. It's the first thing that emerges, and it's gaining energy and steam ever since that point above anything that's supposed to be, you know, native that comes up. So you see very things that are now very obvious, like the dwarf larkspur explosion. And visitors come here now just to see that in April. Usually it peaks around the first week of April. It's a focal point of our wildflower hikes with the rangers. So you see that, and that's a great success story that we can articulate, I think, pretty well to the park visitor. And then you go to some of the lesser known species, and we're doing hikes to focus on this. We've partnered with Penn State University, the Division of Natural Areas, and the staff and the Friends Group on a couple endangered plants that have emerged from these areas, or we've discovered in these areas we've removed exotic plants.
What are those plants?
The primary ones right now that we're studying is one called Eastern Yampa. It's a plant that emerges about March, second week of March. It likes rocky areas, grows on some of our ridgetops. We're generally finding in areas where there's exposed limestone. And that plant, if you can imagine a carrot leaf, that's what it looks like when it emerges in the ground. It's got a white flower on it that a lot of people associate to maybe like Queen Anne's Lace or something like that. And then the other one is one that we're researching that is kind of a focus at the end of September, one called nodding rattlesnake root. And that plant We had found it before. I think I found it around 2004 in some of our drainage areas. I didn't know what it was, and I couldn't figure it out. Roger McCoy figured it out for us when he was out here, and we registered that plant, and we've been doing research on it for about 5 years. There's two, and we've learned there's a couple of factors on it. Invasive exotic plants is one. The other is human impact is huge on it. It grows to about 6 to 8 foot tall, but has a root system of less than 6 inches.
Okay.
And two, deer love it when it matures. About September, we're still figuring out the whys, but about September when it matures, it becomes very attractive to deer. They don't seem to bother it until that time. So if you're ever out here hiking on the road and you see two or three plants in cages, that's that plant. We put cages around it. We had the first successful bloom in Davidson County's history in September of 2015. It has a yellow flower on it. And Roger registered that with UT Herbarium, and now it's now an annual occurrence for us. So we've kind of figured that one out. It likes drainage areas. It's got to have the right amount of moisture, right amount of sunlight. That research with Dr. Loeb, who's our partner at Penn State, has really paid off. So we're looking forward to continuing that and then publishing on it. We're getting close. We know the invasive exotics held it back and kept it from being able to be successful to a certain degree. The same thing with the Eastern Yampa. And then the other one that we know less about, we're figuring out, it's a newer one, is the Deems three-seeded mercury or copper leaf. And that one has some impact from invasive plants, but we're still figuring out the parameters on it.
Have you noticed with the removal of the invasives any change in the prevalence of certain types of birds or different species of that?
Yeah, and it depends on what plant comes in. But yes, just density alone. Now, that also changes some of your ecosystem. So we had areas like the Hall Farm. It was predominantly bush honeysuckle in 2001. We've removed it and privet. We've removed it, and we're still taking care of tree heaven there. But we just burned 15 acres there on March 4th. We've burned it two or three times as part of this cycle to get it back.
Are you trying to maintain a prairie back there?
We're trying to get it into a savanna/prairie state.
Okay.
We feel that our most critical environment to sustain Radnor Lake for the next 100 years is native grass areas.
Okay.
For ground nesting birds. If you drive around Radnor Lake for more than about 15 minutes, you'll realize the only grassy areas are yards. That's not natural. That's fescue. That's fescues, which...
Or Bermuda grasses.
Or Bermuda grasses.
Right.
So that's really a focus of our resource management plan that we established in 2016. That is a focus of a lot of our energy and efforts. And ironically, it overlaps a lot with our invasive exotic plant removal process. The burning, and I'm getting back to your question the long way, we're seeing things like common milkweed this year exploded in the Hall Farm area from our burn and the exotic plant removal. That's a host plant, a critical host plant for butterflies.
For butterflies, exactly.
So that's the changes you're seeing.
Right.
So we're seeing that. And listen, all of this comes back to our primary focus. We're a wildlife observation area. Unique hiking wildlife observation opportunities. I think all that's enhancing that for our visitors.
You know, the Hall Track is a little bit off the beaten path for the park visitor. Is there a way for the park visitor to actually get back and see that property?
Yeah, in May 1st, 2015, we opened the Barbara J. Mapp Aviary Center.
Exactly.
The Hall Drive became part of our trail system.
Okay.
So it's now reflected on that. The maps of the parking lot, actually, now we're replacing those currently to reflect that. But all of our new maps have that on there. It's a 0.4-mile paved surface up to the Aviary Center.
Okay.
And those areas that we burned, you can walk right by.
Okay.
Right in. So
okay.
It's a good birding area. If you're a birder, things like indigo bunting, you'll find there where you won't find them in a lot of the other areas of the park, the natural area. So, it's about...
So there's a gate up there at the top of that hill.
That's for the Aviary Center, but that road is open all the time for visitors to
walk. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Excellent.
If we're open, that road's open.
Excellent, excellent.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this while I've got you here, and I know that you've had some excitement this spring with the forest fire. In my experience with parks, that's kind of a rare bird to actually have a forest fire within the park itself. That must have been hair-raising.
It is, but we were ready for it.
Tell us about what happened.
April 4th, I believe, we had about 5:30 p.m. We had a fire, which we've determined to originate from Bench 41 on Gainey Ridge Trail. We got a call. We were contacted. Some folks thought they smelled smoke. Me and another ranger were just, Ranger Paul Schauer, working with a volunteer group, and we were actually headed around to go to lunch at about 5 or 5:30, and we got notified on that. And anyway, hiked in, saw the smoke from the east side, hiked into it, got to it in about 15 minutes, going cross country by foot. And then we were able to call in resources. We've got great partners like Tennessee Division of Forestry. John Kirksey, the head guy with them, good friend, he was out there with me till midnight on the fire line.
How many acres were burned?
Just an acre and a third.
Okay.
But the key point of that incident was we had 45 mile an hour winds. So if you've ever worked with fire, wind is a lot of times your greatest adversary. So it wasn't that's not a big fire, but it got very hot. That wind stoked it. So we had trees burning up to about 35 feet high.
Well, and this happened just shortly after the experience that they had in Gatlinburg.
Well, yeah. That was 4 months prior,
right?
And I was there. We worked that too, so
right.
we respond to fires all over the state to help our partners across the entire state. So, last fire season in the fall was a busy season for us. We had a couple fires at Cumberland Trail that we assisted with. We had fires, some smaller fires like Frozen Head and some other parks had some smaller fires, but we have people. We do annual training. I just scheduled 2 training days here for this August that we do every year. We bring rangers in, we recertify them, we do pack tests on the road here. We have a fire trailer ready to go. We do all that training. We put our new rangers through this training. So the Gainey Ridge Fire in April, we had 58 personnel come help us.
And well, fire can be a friend too. It's
absolutely.
Have you noticed any changes on that property since the fire? Interesting to see.
I was up there taking photos on Friday.
What'd you see?
You're seeing mostly good stuff. You see some of the invasive exotic sea, dormant sea. I saw some tree heaven that we're going to need to pull or treat. But it's regenerating. You know, fire is a natural process. It's not a process we want to mess with when it's 45 mile an hour winds.
Exactly.
But
you'd rather have it under
process.
Control, yeah.
So just the same reason we burned 15 acres of the Hall Farm in March, it's this process that if you do it in a controlled manner, and go to the lengths that we go to in preparing for it. Our ranger staff do a lot of prep work on these areas before we ever light a match. So people would be amazed the amount of work and effort that goes into planning these. And we come up with parameters with Division of Forestry, who are great to work with. You know, the wind's got to be between X and Y for us to actually ever start the prescribed burn. We've got all these backup plans. So our wildfire response on Gainey, Forestry brought a dozer in and had it on a truck sitting on the road for us. We never had to get it off the truck.
I wondered about that.
But that was our backup.
Yeah.
For our backup. Our top concern and priority is the safety of our residents that join us, our landowners, and our visitors to the park.
Right.
Neither were ever in any danger in that incident. But, you know, most people don't know this. We've had 3 fires over the last maybe 9 years. About every 2 or 3 years, we have a fire.
I did not know that.
Yeah, illegal campfires a lot of times are the source of those. Utility lines, if tree falls into utility line or during a dry spell, we'll have that. Most of those are small fires. We had a fire in 2 or 3 years ago on our southern boundaries, illegal campfire. Okay. It started on the river, burned about 4 acres.
You know, this park also had some ill effects from the flooding that occurred in Davidson County 6-8 years ago.
2010.
Okay, so 7 years ago. Yeah. The Park Road, Otter Creek Road, that used to be open to vehicular traffic, washed out in some places. What are the plans as far as that go? Are we just going to let what is there now?
Well, the plan will be whatever the hillside lets us do.
Okay.
Is the short answer.
Right.
There's a long way to get there. The road was closed for 37 days, and we patched it ourselves. We put about $10,000 worth of rock and materials and rental equipment to get that back open for the public to use. So that was some challenging times. In the big scale of things, it was a very small issue compared to all the more serious stuff that was going on in Nashville at that time, with people affected a lot greater. We had 40 landslides in the Nashville area that we documented and done research
as a result of that flood.
As a result of, so the issue with the flood here, at least in our little world here at Radnor, was not so much high water. It was the effect of water on soil, the types of soil we have, and what that weight and that amount of water did in a short amount of time. We call those slides.
We
had about 40 slides. And the road was the most prominent visible area, and the road slid into the lake. Now, the irony of that was, that's how we closed the road in 2002. We said that was going to happen. We knew it was. You can see it.
Yeah, there was the cross drainage in that road has never been appropriate.
Yeah, and also the trees told us that. If you hike that road and look at the trees, anywhere you've got that soil slippage, you'll see trees that grow at the bottom in a curvature from the base. We call that creep. It's one of the geologic terms we use. That soil is slowly moving. That hillside is slowly moving. And other than a huge engineering feat, like bulldozing the entire hillside and concrete foundations and all those things, you're limited on what you can do within reason. And spending, you know, we're responsible for taxpayer dollars.
Right.
So do we want to repave that road and it look good for 2 or 3 years and it slide back in the lake? We don't think that's a good use of the taxpayers' dollars. So we've patched it. A long-term plan for Radnor and that road is it will be a greenway path. And our width will be a lane and a third. And everybody says, why a lane and a third? The width of an ambulance where we do our medical response on our trails. We can get an ambulance through there and load an injured visitor. I'm an EMT. We do medical response on the trails. That's our plan for the road. So what we've chosen...
Has that been costed out and put in the...
We've had a couple of
estimates made and all
we've
that.
We've had several engineers look at it. We've had a paving estimate done last year. Okay. We just don't think it's financially a smart thing to do based on the engineering that we've got at this time.
The Greenway Trail idea that you talked about, a lane and a third, is that project in the works, or
well,
is that...
it's in the plan.
Okay.
But when we get back to dollars, when we talk about...
It's not a high priority.
It's a lower priority from this standpoint.
Okay.
We're trying to buy all the land we can right now.
Okay.
So
that's
land,
a higher priority.
Land is a higher priority.
I got you.
And we want... the road will stay open for visitors to use. It's a multi-purpose road. We grandfathered in a lot of the uses like bicycles and dogs and jogging. So we're always going to have that. That's part of our overall plan and use for the natural area. It will always be open for visitors to utilize. It's down to a lane in that one section of about 150 feet. We're going to maintain that open. And then I think at some point there will be a grant opportunity, some enhancement type money that will make real good sense on us doing that. We're already seeing some new opportunities come up. We're looking at things like recycled tire.
Mm-hmm.
Asphalt
mm-hmm.
and things like that. We're looking at some very green ideas.
They have paving products that mm-hmm. allow water to percolate through and that sort of thing.
So we're looking at all those as maybe a better, more efficient solution on what you would historically do to a roadway.
What are the visitor statistics these days in this park, Steve?
We were up 300,000 visitors last year, 1.3 million. I just got the visitation numbers. One of our rangers pulled it for me the other night. We were almost at 800,000 visitors for the first 6 months of the year.
And how do you keep those?
Traffic count. The standardized formula in state parks is traffic counter data.
Okay.
The plus and take of that is it doesn't account for everybody that bicycles or jogs in or walks in, which we have a high percentage of that here, given our geographic location.
Right.
And that formula is... certain number of visitors per car average, and that gives you that total. So we also have other things like our interpretive programming numbers, our volunteer numbers. So when you go across the traffic counter on a bus, that counts as 2 point visitors instead of 50.
So it's an underestimated.
So
at
times it can be.
Yeah.
And you know, if your park has a lot of, if your park usage demographic is a lot of single car users, that also works the other way.
And how does that put you, where does that put you in terms of ranking?
Well, we have, I'll be honest with you, across the state, we're probably fourth or fifth.
Okay. So
we're in the top five, I think. And listen, Nashville's growing. The last study I saw out of Vanderbilt was about 100 new people a day to Middle Tennessee. We want to welcome all of them. We want them to come to Radnor. And it's just a balancing act for us. Our goal is to keep Radnor like it was in 1973. It was the right idea at the right time. And I would like to tell you, my job is rocket science. It's not. It's just not to mess up that original concept that Governor Dunn and all those great people had at that time. It was a great idea. It was new for Tennessee. It's now turned into 86 natural areas out of that same concept. The Division of State Parks is the managing agency for Radnor. It's a beautiful fit to what is needed at Radnor. Education is a big component and a big part of what we do, whether it's a ranger talking to a visitor on a trail or us actually doing a full-blown interpretive program at our aviary center with the bird of prey. So all those things, there's challenges. Our goal with our land acquisition is historically preserving the area was to make it a box or a circle, and it's defendable long-term. We've actually been doing the opposite the last 10 years. We want to connect to the Forest Hills Greenway. We want you to be able to walk from Brentwood to Radnor Lake and have the option that Radnor is a hiking destination rather than driving there, waiting in line, and getting out to
the hiking or a biking destination.
Now, that's, we're always going to have that option.
Yeah.
And we want to make sure we maintain that the best way possible.
Right.
But part of that healthy living initiative that's been started, that's a governor initiative that's been working through the last couple of years, this whole movement, especially in Middle Tennessee, that we've seen of people getting more engaged with the outdoors and that fitting more into healthy lifestyle, we think all that fits that. We think it's a perfect fit. And our regular visitors especially, things like Gagnier Ridge, if you like that hike, we're working on developing a 3-mile trail to Franklin Road that's Gagnier Ridge times two. It's going to scratch that.
Well, this is with the new property.
That's the new property that we're working on. We're going to close it out by December 31st on buying the land. We're a year ahead of schedule.
Terrific.
So it's a lot of good stuff. I'm excited, and I'm glad to be a small part of it.
Well, Steve, I thank you for being with us today and spending this 40 minutes. It goes pretty quickly.
It does.
You guys are doing a terrific job out here.
Thank you. I appreciate the support.
Good to see you.
Thank you, sir.
All right.